be here with you this morning. Some of you may have heard that someone called Joe Vitale was speaking today, and you probably pictured an Italian-American from New York. If so, I'm sorry for any confusion. That's actually my husband, Vince. But I can understand why you would find the name confusing. I myself did when Vince and I were actually on honeymoon, and we had a hypothetical conversation about what kind of names we might call any future children that we had. And Vince suggested, well, what about Joseph? That's a nice name. To which I replied, no way. We can't call our child Joseph because then he'll get nicknamed Joey Vitale, and that is way too mafia sounding. At which point Vince just stared at me and then began to laugh, and it took me a few seconds to catch on before I exclaimed in horror, oh no, that's my name. I'm Joey Vitale. I don't look like my name. But I think actually this is something that we do all the time, isn't it? We make assumptions about people that we hear about. We kind of imagine what they might be like before we've even met them, simply on the basis of their name or where they come from or the rumors that we've heard about them, whether or not they're actually true. And I think in no more situation is this more true than when it comes to the rumors that we hear about the God of the Bible. Just last month, a new book was published in the States by the atheist Dan Barker, and the book is called God, the Most Unpleasant Character in All Fiction. And now this book is basically a sustained attack on the character of the God of the Old Testament, whom Barker actually finds really abhorrent. And I was reading the reviews on Amazon, and I actually just started crying. So I just thought, gosh, the things that are being said about God in this book that people are going to read, and they're going to go away and they'll never read anything else about God, and they'll just believe all of these lies about him. But I think actually these days, everywhere we go, time and again, we come up against similar kind of challenges and attacks, don't we, against the character of the Christian God. And I think behind many of these rumors, these critiques of the God of the Bible, we actually find a strong underlying challenge, which is this. If God is supposed to be loving, then why does he go around judging everybody? After all, aren't those two characteristics inherently contradictory? I think it's a question that people are asking. I think it's a good question. And I think it's a significant challenge for us as Christians to have to engage with as well. Because from the beginning to the end of the Bible, we do see these two threads running together. We see the love of God and we see the judgment of God. And I don't think you can take those things apart. But how do they possibly relate to one another? What on earth do love and judgment have in common? How can the Christian God both be a God of love and a God of judgment? With our time together this morning, I want us to take a closer look at both God's love and his judgment and how these two belong together. And I think when it comes to talking about love, the difficulty that we face in our 21st century world is that while everybody seems to be searching for love, nobody is really sure quite what it is. And if you don't believe me, you can just ask Google. According to Google, the number one question most frequently typed into their search engine in the UK in 2014 was this question. What is love? What is love? Alone at night, people are hidden away in their bedrooms without anyone else looking over their shoulder. It's this question that people are secretly and desperately searching for an answer to. What is love? I think these days it could be argued that in the West we have more freedom to love than ever before, and the attainment of love even appears so tantalizingly close. You know, it's only one click of an app away these days. You can, you know, just date online. You can meet people so easily. So then why is it that the real deal, that true love, often seems more elusive than ever? Less people than ever before are getting married in the UK, and of those who do, around 42% wind up getting divorced. And in fact, it's likely that many of us here, even this morning, will have been hurt by the breakdown of a serious relationship, whether it's that of our parents or friends or family members or even our own. The other day I was on the motorway and I drove past a massive sign advertising a website called maritalaffairs.co.uk, the UK's number one marital affair website, where the grass is always greener. You know, as I went past that sign, I actually just felt sick to my stomach, because I just thought about the number of people who've been hurt through those who've chosen to use that website, and just the thought that someone out there is getting rich off of the betrayal and breakdown of other people's relationships, it just seems so wrong. But with so much broken trust, it's no wonder that we get disillusioned, is it? Because even if you find somebody that you can trust enough to want to commit to them in this life, you still have to face the reality that actually they're not going to be perfect any more than you are. The closer you get to somebody, the more clearly you see not only their virtues, but also their flaws as well. In fact, ironically, I think it's usually the people we're closest to who we actually hurt the most, because they're the ones who have to bear the brunt of our self-centered behavior. And even if you do manage to overcome these challenges and you're blessed enough to spend your life waking up in the morning face to face with a special someone, you're still left with that deep down sickening fear that one day you'll open your eyes and they won't be there anymore. Because even love can't conquer death, right? One way or another, every relationship is headed for heartbreak. And it honestly seems like those happily ever after promises only exist in fairy tales. I think the band Muse capture a prevalent feeling of this generation with these lyrics: don't kid yourself and don't fool yourself. This love's too good to last and I'm too old to dream. And yet I think there's something inside of us that just screams out against resigning ourselves to this depressing fate, that questions, is that really all there is? You know, I think there's a reason that losing a loved one just tears you apart, because there's a sense of total wrongness about it. There's a feeling it's not supposed to be this way, that we were made for more than this. Reflecting on our common human experience, C.S. Lewis concludes, if I find in myself desires that nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. And this morning I want to suggest to you that actually those yearnings that we feel are correct, that there really is a good answer to that question, what is love, that goes deeper than just our pheromones or the evolutionary drive to procreate. It's just that we've been looking for that answer in all the wrong places. You know, according to Christianity, it's completely natural to long for a love that nothing in this world can satisfy, because Christianity says that you are made for a love bigger than anything this world has to offer. Christianity says you are made by God and for God, and God is love itself. That's what the Bible has to say. God is love. And this love that God has for you is a love at its very best. It's a love that's different to the way that our world around us tends to talk about love. Because I think in our world, we're consistently told that love is something you need to earn, that we need to prove to other people that we're worthy of their love by being smarter or funnier or more successful or better looking than everybody else. And sometimes we can get so caught up in this mindset of having to prove ourselves to other people, of making ourselves worthy, that it can get completely out of control. One of my friends was telling me the other day that some of his friends will actually stop by the gym to lift weights on their way out to a date, just in order to pump up their muscles to impress the girl that they're going to meet for the evening, which is just a ridiculous thought, isn't it? I can kind of imagine their biceps like slowly deflating over the course of the evening. Look at the things we do just to try and be impressive enough. But whenever we behave in these kinds of ways, we're basically buying in this unspoken rule that there's a standard that every person is measured against. And how well you measure up will determine your lovability and your worth. But you know, if that's how God sees us too, then we are in real trouble. Because if his love is determined by how well we measure up, what are we supposed to do if we think we need to deserve love and even other people can be too good for us? Then how much further out of our league must a perfect God be? This is how religion is sometimes presented to us, that if you're good enough, then God will love you. But Christianity says something different. Christianity is a faith that's less to do with religion and so much more to do with a relationship. A relationship with a God that says love is not about deserving. Instead, Christians worship a God who loved us while we were still sinners and while we were still far off. God's love for you won't rely on how well behaved you are or how good you look. God's love for you doesn't even rely on you loving him back. You know, with God, you never have to wake up in the morning and wonder if he's still into you, because he always will be. Nor is God's love for you faint-hearted or feeble. In fact, quite the opposite. It's very determined and very intentional. A few years ago, one of my good friends had given up on relationships because actually she'd been hurt so badly that she was just done with it. And she thought, you know what, I'm just going to stay single. And during this time, she moved to Florence to go and write a book out there. But while she was there, she suddenly met this guy who seemed really interested in her, but she was very careful to keep her distance and she was sort of pushing him away because she was scared of getting hurt again. However, one morning while she was getting her usual cappuccino at her favourite little coffee shop, the waiter suddenly came over to her carrying a beautiful Gerbera daisy, which is my friend's favourite flower. You can just sort of make it out there. And from then on, several times every week, whenever she'd go to her favourite local restaurants or coffee shops, a stranger would come over to her and deliver to her one of these Gerbera daisies. And then even when she moved from Florence back to California, which is her home, and she returned to her local Starbucks, the first morning she walked in the door and the server came up to her and handed her a Gerbera daisy. Literally everywhere she went, these daisies were already waiting for her. Gentlemen in the congregation, I hope you're paying attention because this is a very good way to impress a lady. Slightly stalkerish perhaps, but it's pretty awesome. But you know, the man she met, he wasn't pushy. He didn't force her to do anything that she didn't want to do, but neither did he give up on her. Instead, he was persistent. He went out of his way to show her day in and day out that he was thinking about her, that he desired her, that he thought she was worth pursuing. And it's that kind of affection that God has for us, a love that doesn't quit. In one of Jesus' stories, he describes God as like a shepherd who's lost one single sheep out of 99. And you'd think that if you manage to hold on to 99 sheep out of 100, you'd think, I'm not doing a bad job, actually. That's pretty good. And yet this shepherd refuses to rest until he finds that one lost sheep, and he searches high and low, and he never gives up until he's found the sheep, and then he brings it home and throws a massive party. This is a God who is fierce in his pursuit of us. He doesn't give up on anyone. His hand is outstretched towards each one of us. Now, you may be sitting here thinking, well, that all sounds pretty great. So far, so good, right? But actually, there's a problem with this picture of divine romance. And the problem, I'm afraid to say, is us. It's actually worth asking yourself the question, if you haven't thought about it before, if Christianity was true, would you want it to be? If God is real, would you want to know him? Because I think for many of us, actually, this isn't such an easy question to answer. Because honestly, we're more comfortable as we are. Thank you very much. We like running our own lives. We're quite happy doing our own thing. The famous atheist philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche once summed it up really well when he said this: if there's a God, how can I bear not to be him? We don't want some God to come along and start interfering or changing us. To many of us, that idea doesn't appeal at all. And at heart, it's the same reason why so many of our human relationships fail as well. Because actually really loving someone means putting them before yourself. And most of the time, we don't want to put anyone before ourselves. We're much better at self-love. Christians call this sin, caring more about yourself than God or anybody else, and therefore living in selfish ways that lead us to hurt others with our choices, our words and our actions. And this sin, this self-love, it actually puts up a massive wall between us and God, destroying chance for meaningful relationship with him. And actually the problems facing us and any chance for a relationship with God are actually even bigger than this. Because if God really loves us, then that means he actually has to judge us for our sins. Now, that might seem like a really bizarre thing for me to say. Often we think of these two as opposites, don't we? Love and judgment. But let me explain what I mean. In our contemporary culture, judgment is not a popular word. We think of it as old-fashioned and politically incorrect. We're all about tolerance. We don't go around judging people. And therefore we think, if God is so loving, why doesn't he just forgive everyone? After all, isn't that what we've been taught to do ever since we were children? So why then can't God practice what he preaches? It's actually a question that I used to really struggle with a lot myself, until one day something happened that radically changed my thinking on this whole issue. And actually the trigger for me was while I was at university, when one of my friends went through the terrible trauma of being raped. And, you know, seeing her deal with the consequences of that, seeing the fear that she had to live with every single day, and the guilt and shame that she felt for something that actually she had no reason to feel guilty for, and the way that she began to hate her body and punish herself by not eating, and the way that she would go from one messed up relationship to another, because ever since that day, she just can't cope with the idea of intimacy anymore. You know, actually, there are no words to describe the horror of that, or how devastated and angry that I felt seeing her that way. And how badly I wanted the man who did that to her and who actually got away with it to be held accountable for what he'd done and to receive judgment. And that was when I realized, if I cannot stand to see my friends, the people that I love, mistreated, then how much more frustrated must a God who loves every single one of us more than we could possibly imagine be for all the ways that we wrong and hurt each other. You know, this morning, some of you here have actually been treated very badly, and that matters to God. We think of love and judgment as opposites, but they're not. The two go hand in hand. It's precisely because God loves us so much that he says there must be judgment for the ways that we've wronged each other. If he didn't judge, he'd be saying he doesn't care that we've been hurt. The theologian Miroslav Volf says it this way: I used to think that anger was unworthy of God. Isn't God love? Shouldn't divine love be beyond anger? But my last resistance to the idea of God's anger was a casualty of the war in former Yugoslavia, the region from which I come. 200,000 people were killed and over 3 million were displaced. My villages and cities were destroyed. My people shelled day in and day out, some of them brutalized beyond imagination. And I could not imagine God not being angry. How did God react to the carnage? By doting on the perpetrators in a grandfatherly fashion, by refusing to condemn the bloodbath, but instead affirming the perpetrators' basic goodness? Wasn't God fiercely angry with them? Though I used to complain about the indecency of the idea of God's anger, I came to think that I would have to rebel against a God who wasn't angry at the sight of the world's evil. The truth is, when we or anyone we love has been treated unjustly, we find ourselves crying out for justice, because that's what you do when you love someone. I think to those of us who've never been the victims of serious injustice, the idea of God's judgment might seem severe. But actually, to the millions of people around the world who are victims of the most brutal injustice every single day, the belief that one day God will ensure justice by judging the world is actually the very hope that they cling to in their suffering and in their pain, as they cry out to God with the very same question that Abraham asks in Genesis chapter 18. Will not the judge of all the earth do right? But the problem, however, is that if we want justice for ourselves and the people that we love, then we also have to be prepared to face justice ourselves. And the idea that we might be judged for anything at all is not so attractive to us. In fact, we quite often have difficulty admitting to ourselves that we've ever done anything wrong. I think sin is a dirty word in our culture. And somehow we've managed to convince ourselves so often that it has nothing to do with us. Vince and I realized how ingrained this perspective had become in our culture when, as an American, he had to take a citizenship test to stay in the UK, which is really hard, by the way. I took 15 practice tests and I only passed 2 of them. Apparently, I'm not English to be in this country. But in the paperwork, one of the questions that he had to answer yes to in order to be allowed to remain in England was the following question: have you or any dependents who are applying with you ever engaged in any other activities which might indicate that you may not be considered to be persons of good character? Isn't that a crazy question to have on a visa application? It was basically asking him to say that he'd never ever done anything wrong. And if he ticked yes, if he ticked no, he would be deported. Apparently, everybody in England is very well behaved. But perhaps it's not surprising that our culture likes to see ourselves this way. We like to think of ourselves as very good people, because actually academic studies have shown that in nearly every area of life, human beings have an inflated sense of self. In fact, apparently, around 90% of people tend to rate themselves as better than average, which when you think about it is a statistical impossibility. You know, the same can be said of our behavior too. We're so quick to point out when other people treat us badly. And yet we're so quick to overlook when we treat others badly. But you know, if we're really honest with ourselves, none of us are blameless. We like to think of sin as other people's problem, but it just doesn't work that way. The Russian author Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who served in a Soviet labor camp for 8 years in the 1940s, he says it this way: "If only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of their own heart?" I was recently reading my 2-year-old goddaughter Karis the nursery rhyme Humpty Dumpty, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. The end. How brutal is that for a children's fairy tale? I'd never thought about it before, but actually that's a tragic ending. They can't put him back together again. And this is a story that we tell our 2-year-olds. And yet, actually, as I reflected on it, I thought, wow, isn't that an honest story? Because at a deep level, I think the truth behind the story is striking. Humpty Dumpty is the story of every one of us. It's the story of the human condition. We've all fallen off the wall. We're all lying in pieces. And as hard as they may try and we may try, nobody can put us back together again. The Bible describes it this way: all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. We've all fallen off the wall. Through our sinfulness, we've broken relationship with God, we've broken relationship with other people, and in turn, we've broken ourselves. But then what should God do? At first glance, it seems like we've put him in an impossible situation. He loves each one of us so much that he cannot stand to see us be victims of injustice, so he has to judge. And yet, if he takes sin seriously, if he treats it as it deserves, then we will have to pay a serious penalty for the ways that we've hurt other people and the ways that we've hurt God. And as a God of love, he cannot stand to see us pay that penalty. From this perspective, it seems impossible. By our own actions, we've sabotaged any possibility of true love with the one we were made for. But thankfully, nothing is impossible with God. Earlier, we looked at some cultural definitions of love. Let's take a look now at Christianity's definition of love. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. What would it take for someone to prove that they really loved you? Do they buy you dinner? Do they sit through hours of baseball with you even though they don't have a clue what the rules are and they keep accidentally cheering for the wrong team? That's how I try and love my husband. Do they look after you when you're sick? Do they share a bank account with you? Usually the more they're willing to give up for you, the more you can be sure of their love. You know, it'd be hard to doubt someone's love for you if they willingly took a bullet for you. And at the heart of the Christian message, this is exactly what we find: Jesus Christ dying on a cross for you. And just try and get your heads around that for a second, because actually it's completely mind-blowing that the same God who created the universe is strung up on a cross, bleeding out and gasping for breath. One more writer has put it this way: the world takes us to a silver screen on which flickering images of passion and romance play, and the world tells us this is love. God takes us to the foot of a tree on which a naked and bloodied man hangs, and he says, "This is love." In the States, they have a law called the Statute of Limitations. And what this law means is that actually, if a person who's committed a certain crime is not caught within a set period of time, then once that time has lapsed, they can no longer be convicted of the crime, even if they were the ones who actually committed it. And perhaps one reason why a law like this could make sense is because sometimes people can change so radically over time that at some point it's no longer just to convict that person of a crime they committed so long ago, because it would actually be like convicting a completely different person. But what I want to suggest to you is that at the cross, Jesus makes available to us a divine statute of limitations effective immediately. At the cross, we find the same God who is judge of all, refusing to condemn us to the fate we deserve for our sins. And instead, God condemns himself in our place. Jesus takes our sentence. He literally switches places with us. He suffers our punishment so that we don't have to pay that price that we owe. And in return, the only man who's never sinned gives us his innocent status so that when God looks at us, he no longer sees our guilt. Instead, because of Jesus, God sees a new person. He sees an innocent person. Justice demands judgment, and love demands mercy. And it's only at the cross that we see the love of God and the justice of God found in perfect intersection. The writer Ellis Potter has noted that actually there's one very important line missing from the children's nursery rhyme, Humpty Dumpty. And the line is this: Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. But the king could. The king could. And the king did. And then he cried out from the cross, "It is finished." The Bible describes this experience of God putting us back together again, of becoming a Christian, as like becoming a new creation. As Jesus himself says, "I've come that they might have life and have it in abundance," to live abundantly. And all we have to do is say sorry for our sins and accept his death on our behalf. And we're forgiven and freed, and our lives are changed forever. But you know, although this response required of us is so simple, it's just literally reaching out and taking Jesus' hand, just accepting a gift, I think actually for some of us, this can be the hardest thing of all to believe. You know, after years of studying deep questions and thinking hard, I've come to a place where I don't doubt for a second that Jesus is the Son of God. And I believe with all my heart that God raised him from the dead. But forgiveness for someone like me, no condemnation for me, no more beating myself up about the poor choices I made this morning or yesterday or 3 years ago or 10 years ago. Now, I met my husband Vince at a time in my life where I was really struggling with a lot of guilt over bad choices that I'd made in the past. And I felt so unworthy of love. And I was convinced that if Vince really knew the truth about me, then he definitely wouldn't want to be with me. And so, preferring to get dumped sooner rather than later, I decided to tell him about my past mistakes before our relationship got too serious. But as I told him, I was so ashamed that I actually couldn't look him in the eye. Instead, I just stared at the ground and just cried. But after I told him, Vince just gently said to me, "Joe, look at me." But I couldn't bear to, because I was so terrified that if I looked into his eyes, I would see anger or condemnation or disappointment. But then he said to me again, "Joe, look at me." And then he took my face in his hands and he raised it until we were eye to eye. And I was astonished by what I saw, because I expected to see judgment and condemnation, but all I saw was compassion and love. And then he said to me lovingly, but firmly, "That is not who you are anymore. That is not who you are anymore." And I think it was in that moment that I finally got it. Because looking into Vince's eyes for the first time, I think I really understood how God sees me. Sometimes we can be so scared to look at God because we're afraid of what we're going to see in his eyes. Judgment, disappointment, rejection. But when we accept Jesus' death on our behalf, then at the cross, it's as if God takes our face in his hands and he raises it until we're looking into his eyes. And then he says to us, "That is not who you are anymore." And you know, for some of you, today may be the first time that actually that's really sinking in for you, that actually the life you're living doesn't look anything like the sort of selfless, beautiful life of love that you were created for. Others of you, even as Christians, may have spent your whole lives trying to prove yourselves or beating yourselves up for past mistakes and just deep down believing that you yourself are not worthy of love. But whatever the case, because of Jesus, there's nothing any of us have ever done or ever could do that would put us out of God's reach. There's literally nothing you could do to make him love you less. Today, at this very moment, God is offering us, every one of us, a love like no other, a love based totally, not on deserving, but on grace, a love that's for you, that is relentless in its pursuit of you, that will never give up, never call it quits, never fail, and a love that has literally conquered death so that you can know a love that lasts forever. You know, you could spend your whole life searching for a love like this, and people do, they do all the time, but you'll never find anything like it anywhere else. And if that's what you're looking for today, if maybe you're one of those people who's typed into Google at night, what is love? And you've been wondering about it over sleepless nights, then hear what Jesus says to every one of us. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. Rest because you can finally be free from the endless cycle of having to prove yourself worthy of love. And instead, you can finally relax and just enjoy it. And I really felt that word from God this morning, just as we're coming into this meeting, just feeling like God was saying, actually, do you enjoy my love? I want you to enjoy it. You know, are you enjoying knowing me? Because I'm enjoying knowing you. I take pleasure in your company. Earlier, I asked the question, if God were real, would you want to know him? And it may be that some of you here this morning, the answer to that is actually yes. I do want to know him. I want to know his love like this, the love that I was made for. You know, either because you're not a Christian, but you'd like to be one, or because, you know, he's felt distant for a long time and you haven't felt like you're living in that place of rest and enjoyment and love. And if that's you this morning, if you want to come back to God, or if you want to know him, if you want to know this love for the first time, then I'm just going to take a moment to pray now. And I'd invite you just to repeat those words with me in your heart. Let's pray. God, your love amazes me, and I thank you that even though I could never deserve it or earn it or prove myself impressive enough, that actually you're a God who loved me enough to die for me. I'm so sorry for the times that I've run away from you, where I haven't believed in the magnitude of your love, where I've tried to work towards you like a slave instead of a child, where I haven't enjoyed you. I'm sorry for the times I've turned my back on you, for sinning against you, for breaking our relationship, for hurting other people. God, please would you forgive me? I thank you that you traded places with me and you took my sin on yourself so that I could be free, so that I could be made innocent, so that I could have the life you've died to give me and be in a relationship with you. I want to know your love for myself this morning. I want to know you more deeply. I want to know you better. I want to rest in you. Please, would you come into my life? Would you renew me and restore me? And would you show me how to love like you have loved me? Would I know what it means to be a new creation and to know that that's not who I am anymore? Because now I'm your child and you call me beloved. Amen.